Blog Talk Radio. Djokovic was up 5-4, 15-40 with a chance to break, you know, we had two break points with a chance to win the set. And Federer, you know, served his way out of trouble. From then on, yeah, I had a pretty, you had a pretty good feeling about what Roger, about Roger Federer. He just, I don't think it took Djokovic basically two sets to recover from that, or at least a set to recover from that. Second set, he would, you know, loses 6-3 and then finally wakes up in the third set. But by, you know, you get down. Listen, Federer has never lost a match. I believe he's never lost a match when he's in a Grand Slam match when he's been up two sets to love. I think he's 175-0. So he is a tremendous, tremendous front runner when he get, you know, when he gets up in these Grand Slam, in these Grand Slams. So we have the, you know, the showdown, another showdown coming up tomorrow between Federer and Nadal. Excuse me. And certainly, Nadal is seeking Grand Slam number 10, French Open number 6, Federer seeking French Open number 2, and Grand Slam number 17. Certainly, you have to favor Nadal. I mean, Nadal has been the most dominant clay court player in the history of the sport, even surpassing Bjorn Borg, who had a great run in the 70s, early 80s. With his 5 French Opens. So, you know, Nadal goes in as a favorite, deservedly so. But it's just something about the way Federer played that certainly would not surprise me if Federer is holding that trophy at the end. Remember, Federer, you know, that was a tough match yesterday, you know, 3.5 hours. But Federer has not spent a lot of time on the court this week. He has really taken care of business. He's only dropped one set through 6 matches. He should be fresh going into that matchup. Tomorrow, Nadal, of course, you know the numbers. He owns Federer in head-to-head career-wise, 16-8. He's like 6-2 at Grand Slams, 4-0 on clay at the French Open. Last time they met in 2008 French Open, it was one of the most embarrassing losses. It might be the most embarrassing loss of Roger Federer's Grand Slam career. Went down 6-2, 6-3, 6-2, and 6-love in the third set. 5 games, basically a little over an hour. And again, that was as dominant a performance as I've ever seen with two players, you know, number one versus number two. At the time, Federer was number one. He was number one in the world. And before Nadal would become number one by winning the that Wimbledon, that classic Wimbledon matchup they played in 2008. So Nadal goes in as a favorite, but Federer certainly will. I just have a feeling about Federer tomorrow. In terms of, you know, just feeling like he is sensing that, you know, his career is coming to it, you know, coming to an end. He's amazingly doing what he's doing at the age of 29, which is remarkable. This guy is 29 years old. Most guys are retired, and he's still one of the best players in the world. Still a guy more than capable of winning a Grand Slam. So we'll see what happens with that. Just getting started here on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call chat line for my Blog Talk Radio audience. Chat line is up. If you have anything that's on your mind, a lot to do this weekend. You had the Stanley Cup playoffs. Of course, you had the NBA Finals, which all of a sudden have some juice to it, considering what Dallas did on Thursday night. You have that to talk about, and we will get into all of that, and much, much more coming up on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call.
Coming at you with music and fun. And if you're not careful, you may learn something before it's done.
9 minutes after the 11 o'clock hour on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, Cyril Quinn, taking you to noon today. Saturday morning headlines. This just completed. The Women's French Open final is done. Li Na defeats defending champion Francesca Schiavini 6-4, 7-5, 6-love in the tiebreaker. She just destroyed her in that last tiebreaker. I was watching it before the show started. Li Na becomes the first Chinese player in tennis history to win a Grand Slam. So congratulations to her. You knew you had a good feel about her after what she did to Sharapova. I thought, you know, with everybody being eliminated, no Williams sister, that Sharapova had a slight edge going into this French Open, especially when she got to the semifinals. But Li Na just toyed with her in that semifinals and had a good sense that she, you know, it might have been her time, and it certainly was. She takes out Schiavini in straight sets. Donnie Walsh is out as Knicks president and the general manager. Walsh, 70 years old, citing that he had a lack of energy moving forward. A mutual, this when you know something is fishy, a mutual decision made by Donnie Walsh and one Jim Dolan, who, of course, owns the Knicks. Listen, Donnie Walsh, over the years, has been a very good general manager, borderline being a great general manager. He took the Pacers and turned the Pacers from basically nobody's. I mean, nobody even cared about the Pacers in the 80s. Okay, took that group and got them to the NBA Finals. Down to the NBA Finals with one Hall of Famer. Now, mind you, they caught Chris Mullin at the end of his career. Chris Mullin spent the majority of his Hall of Fame years with the Golden State Warriors. Okay, so he was done. Reggie Miller was the face of that franchise. Down to the finals. I mean, look at the run the Pacers had. They lose the Bulls in '98. Or from 94 on. You know, 94, 95, they get to back-to-back Eastern Conference. They get to the Eastern Conference Finals in 94, 95. They go to the NBA Finals in 95. They go to the NBA Finals in 2000. They take the Bulls. They play the Bulls tougher than anybody ever played the Bulls during the Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Phil Jackson era. Nobody but the Pacers played the Bulls as tough in that Eastern Conference final back in 98, taking them to seven games and having a fourth-quarter lead. They go back to the Eastern Conference Finals in 99. They go to the NBA Finals in 2000. Eastern Conference Finals in 2004 when he lost to the Pistons. I mean, he did a tremendous job with Indiana, and he comes to New York and cleans up, you know, just a mess of what Jim Dolan, Isaiah Thomas, whoever, you know, Isaiah Thomas left for that team, Ernie Grunfeld to a lesser extent. But I put it was mostly on Isaiah Thomas. And Jim Dolan doesn't want to give him $5 million for next season. I mean, that's what it comes down to. Donnie Walsh, you know, he was very nice to say that, you know, running out of energy. Donnie Walsh still wants to be a general manager somewhere. Don't be surprised if in another year or so, once we get past this lockout, this supposed lockout, or once we get past all this labor stuff with the NBA, don't be shocked that Donnie Walsh is somewhere running somebody else's front office. He took over a mess and cleared cap space to get Amari Stoudemire. Yeah, he didn't get Dwayne Wade or LeBron James, but you know what? They didn't want to come there. It wasn't Matt Jerry West when they got LeBron James and Dwayne Wade in New York. They did not want to come there. Well, maybe Jerry West. I mean, that's too strong of a comparison. So now if you're a Knicks fan, you know what you're stuck with now? James Dolan and Isaiah Thomas. That's what you have right now running your franchise. James Dolan and Isaiah Thomas. And I still, to this day, don't believe that Donnie Walsh wanted to make that Carmelo Anthony deal. I still believe that James Dolan pressured and basically forced him to make that move. He takes the high road, says, you know what, I was committed to it. That's give him, I give him credit for taking the high road. The Eighth Circuit Court had heard the argument between the NFL owners' lawyers and the Players Association lawyers and basically told them, you know what, you need to figure this out on your own. I mean, that's what they basically said. Nothing came about out of it as far as any decisions being made. If you are the players, if you're the Players Association, you know, there's an old song by the legendary Kenny Rogers, The Gambler, and I'm sure a lot of people know this, know when to hold them, know when to fold them. If you're a player, it's time to make a deal. It's time to make a deal. You say, it's time to make a deal. And people thought I was crazy when I said the players should have took that March 11th deal proposed by the owners. And then DeMar Smith comes out and says, oh, that's the worst deal in the history of sports. You know what? Right now, the owners can offer you something that's even worse than that deal they wanted to. Seems like both parties are coming closer and closer to making a deal. You had these so-called secret meetings in Chicago. You know, Jerry Jones and Bob Kraft are desperately pushing for a deal to be made. Remember, Jerry just got to, you know, pay some bills on that billion-dollar palace that he just built. But to me, if you're the players, you don't want to put yourself in a situation where you don't have a training camp, okay, and you don't have a certain amount of practice time, and then you have guys getting hurt, you have rookies who don't have a clue, you have second-year players who don't have a clue. That's the last thing you want. If you are the players, you know, players get hurt. You know what? They don't have guaranteed contracts. The players need to start thinking about some of these things. Listen, you're going, 80 days now, 81 days now. The point has been made. It's time to make a deal. The owners have their clear advantage. The judge, you know, when they made the move a couple of weeks back to for the stay in the owner's favor, That might have been the nail in the coffin in favor of the judges. Excuse me, in favor of the owners when the lockout was lifted, or when the lockout was put back on, I should say. Seventeen minutes after 11 o'clock hour. 347-215-6180 is your call number. 347-215-6180 is your call number. When we return, we'll go back to the scene of the crime. Miami, South Beach, American Airlines, the anatomy of a collapse. We'll talk about that in the NBA Finals on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call.
Down in the hole.
Welcome back to this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, 20 minutes after the 11 o'clock hour. Cyril Quinn taking you to 12 o'clock as we discuss the world of sports. Of course, game three tomorrow night in the NBA Finals as the series now shifts to Big D Dallas for the next three games. Miami trying to recover from that other collapse in game two, up 15, 7 minutes and 44 seconds left. 88-73. Dwayne Wade hits a 3-point shot. And then Miami proceeds to go into, you know, their home run trot. Dwayne Wade hits a three, leaves his arm, you know, the follow-through on his shot up in the air for about a good 5 to 10 seconds. He and LeBron, right in front of the Mavericks bench, mind you. He and LeBron, you know, talking to each other. LeBron's punching him in the chest, you know, fake punching him in the chest. And it's just, I mean, this went on for a good 10 seconds at least. You know, this was not one of these celebrations where natural emotion, you know, a high five, a chest bump. This was not one of those good 1 or 2 or 3 second emotional outbursts that you see after a guy gets dunked on or a guy hits his third or fourth straight three in a quarter, something like that. No. This was something that was borderline to me premeditated as far as I'm concerned. And apparently it fired the Mavericks up. Dallas played great down the stretch in that fourth quarter. Made every big shot known to man. Got all the defensive stops they needed. And were able to pull out the victory 95-93. Now, to me, there are so many ways that as much as credit you want to give Dallas Mavericks, you obviously got to give Dallas an awful lot of credit. They've been doing this all postseason. Game one against the Lakers, which to me completely shifted the series in their favor, winning in L.A. down by 16 in that third quarter. Game four against Oklahoma City, which prevented the series from being tied at 2 and basically put the series away at 3-1 in Oklahoma City, getting down 15 fourth quarter. They get into overtime, then finish it off there. So even then, you know, even Portland, they had some nice comebacks in that. Blew a lead, of course, but they've been making a habit of coming back in the postseason. And if you're Miami, first of all, 15 points in the NBA. Anybody who's watched a lot of NBA basketball knows that 15 points is nothing in the NBA. It's nothing. You got a 24-second shot clock. You have 7 minutes and 44 seconds left. That is an eternity in the NBA. I mean, teams can make up 10 points with a 3-point shot in about 2 minutes. You know, I can understand that celebration a little bit more if it was like just a minute left or 2 minutes left, even 3 minutes left. It was almost 8 minutes left of the game, and Miami basically, you know, took their foot off the gas. They mentally checked out after that. They checked out. They apparently forgot that this was the NBA Finals, and apparently forgot that they were playing a team that was known during this postseason for making comebacks. And here's what I understand about Miami, and let's put the celebration aside for a minute, for a second. Eric Spoelstra, okay, last play, Dallas is up 95-93. Dirk Nowitzki just made the left-handed layup, and we'll get to that. We'll get to that play as well. And they have no timeouts left. So there's still 3.6 seconds left. So 3.6 seconds left, you have a timeout. You can advance the ball to half court and get off a very good shot with 3.6 seconds left. Wade and LeBron easily get off a good shot. Why they had no timeouts left, we're going to go through that right now. Here's why they had no timeouts left. Okay, I'll take you through how they use their timeouts. And this is why, if you're a Miami fan, then you should be concerned about Spoelstra moving forward in this series. Spoelstra takes a timeout at mid-late third quarter at 71-63 following a Dirk Nowitzki jump shot. 71-63. So that means it was 73-63. That means it was 71-61. Dirk Nowitzki hits a jump shot, you take a timeout. Don't understand it. Fourth quarter. All right. Spoelstra takes another timeout with 5:28 left, with the score being 88-77. Mind you, 2 minutes ago, basically 2 minutes earlier, it was 88-73. So they go. Dallas goes on a 4-0 run. 4-0 run, and you take a timeout. The next timeout he takes, understandable. Jason Terry hits a jump shot, 3:11 left, 90-86. Again, this one made sense. Your team's reeling. They've cut the lead from 9 to 4. You want to calm your team down. I had no problem with that timeout. Next timeout, the game is tied at 90. After the Nowitzki's layup, 57 seconds left. You want to set up a play with the game being tied. No problem with that timeout. Last timeout, this was their final timeout. This was the 22nd timeout. 93-90. Again, understandable. Dirk Nowitzki just hit a 3-point shot. 26 seconds left. You want to set up a play to get a good shot. And it turned out he did set up a great play. As Mario Chalmers, and they had a little help from Jason Terry, who blew, and it looked like to me that he blew a defensive assignment. But set up a play. LeBron James makes a pass to Chalmers in the corner. Chalmers knocks down a three. So after that, you have no timeouts left. And then Dirk Nowitzki comes down, scores, gets a layup, it goes up 95-93. You basically wasted. You should have had, at worst, without question, one timeout. But you realistically, you should have had two timeouts left. You burn a timeout after Dirk Nowitzki hits a jump shot in the third quarter to make it from take it from a 10-point lead to an 8-point lead. Then you burn a timeout after a 4-0 run midway through the fourth quarter to go from an 15-point lead to an 11-point lead. This is the NBA Finals. This is not Game 7 of an 82-game regular season where you're still trying to teach. I see Greg Popovich take timeouts when early in the first quarter, when his team, is down, say, 10-4 just to make a point. That's fine. You can do that. It's a regular season, long season. You could do it in the regular season. This is the playoffs. This is the finals, more importantly. And then on the play where the game is tied at 93, Nowitzki had everybody in the world, Nowitzki is going to get the ball, had the ball. He gets the ball. And you have a foul to give, and you choose not to use that foul for some reason. What is the point of having a foul to give if you're not going to use it? And Dirk Nowitzki is like, oh, my goodness, no, they're really not going to have a foul to give? I'm out. Layup. That is the type of thing that, to me, if I was a Miami fan or somebody, Pat Riley in that organization, would have to be concerned about moving forward. Games are won and lost. Playoff games are won and lost down the stretch in the fourth quarter. They can be won and lost by coaching or lack thereof. I mean, you saw Phil Jackson in game one against Dallas with the whole substitution pattern where he took what he had for some reason, had Paul Gasol on Dirk Nowitzki instead of Lamar Odom. When the percentages tell you that clearly in that game that Dirk Nowitzki only shot 31% against when Lamar Odom defended him. As it compares to 50 and above against everybody else. This is where coaches earn their money in these moments. And Spoelstra had a rough to say the least, a rough game two. Again, we've seen series turn, especially NBA final series turn, on one game, on one play. Saw it in 95 with Nick Anderson missing a boatload of free throws in that game one when Houston took out Orlando in Orlando, and Orlando went on to get swept in that series. And still to this day, Kenny Smith brings it up all the time because he was on that Houston team that went back-to-back. Had we lost that series, that game, Orlando probably wins that series. The case is, whether you agree with it or not, this is a guy who played on the team, was a starter on that team, matter of fact, and said, hey, that's how big that game was. Orlando, as a young team, you know, Penny Hardaway at the time, 25, 26, Shaq, 25. You know, Shaquille Neal were like 27, 26, 27, very young team. They never recovered from that. Go back even further, 84 NBA Finals, Lakers in total control, up 2-1, game four at home, has a huge lead, big lead in that game four, second half. You know, the clothesline on Kurt Rambis, Boston, after Larry Bird had called his team sissies in the previous game when they were blown out, they win that game in overtime and go on to win the series in seven, went clearly. Everybody told me, even the Celtics said that the Lakers probably in 84 had a better team. You know, 2006 with game three with Miami and Dallas. Dallas in total control of the series, up 13 in the third quarter, lose that game and never won another game. Now, I expect Miami to bounce back. And I expect that game three, that will be extremely competitive. But this series was over at 88-73. This series, not only that game was over, this series was over. And you and Miami, because of their arrogance and just lack of execution from the, you know, coaching staff on down in the last couple minutes of the fourth quarter, allowed Dallas to get off the mat, and it might come back to bite him in the ass moving forward. 347-215-6180. 347-215-6180. Saturday morning wake up call. When we return, we'll get into some baseball, and we'll also talk about the big Aristotle that's coming up, and much, much more on this latest edition of the Saturday morning wake up call. Morning wake up call. Some late night baseball scores of note. Texas knocking out all over Cleveland 11-2. Indians are struggling right now, lost 7-10. Still find themselves 5 games in the loss column, though, ahead of the second place Detroit Tigers. Cincinnati edges the Dodgers 2-1. St. Louis all over Chicago, over all over the Chicago Cubs 6-1. You have you have Seattle shutting out Tampa Bay 7-0. Seattle continues to be a surprise in that AL West. San Francisco over Colorado 3-1. Arizona shuts out the Nationals 4-0. San Diego over Houston 3-1, and the Angels of Los Angeles. The Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, I should say, edged New York Yankees 3-2. Dice K is going to have Tommy John surgery, so that's going to be it for him as far as the Red Sox are concerned. You know, think about everything they had to go through in terms of the money that they spent to get Dice K, and you know he had the one good year. Had the one good year a couple of years ago, but it has been just basically a waste of money, a waste of time, a waste of energy as far as his career goes. I mean, he walks the ballpark, you know, can't get out of fourth and fifth inning. That's, you know, everyone just about gets everybody except the Toronto Blue Jays. So Dave, if you're a Red Sox fan, that, you know, that has to burn it. You know, that money could have went towards, you know, your farm system, other players, other pitchers, so that has to be frustrating if you're a Red Sox fan. But they still have, you know, you still have Beckett, Lester, and Buchholz, so they still have a decent top of the starting rotation. If they can get Lackey back on track, they should be fine from that standpoint. A couple stories to note that came out of baseball this week that I want to talk about. One, and this came out a couple of days ago, or even yesterday, where 9 out of the 30 teams were in violation of baseball's debt service rules. And it's kind of confusing. I mean, first of all, I'm not surprised, but not shocked by that particular number with the economy. But it was shocking to see which teams were on that list. Number one, the Dodgers and Mets, of course. I mean, we know what's going on with the McCourts and with Madoff and that whole ordeal with those two teams. So that wasn't surprising at all. Texas, you know, despite the fact that they have $91 million payroll, not shocked considering that they were in debt last year and had been taken over by Major League Baseball. So you see a couple of the Nationals, $57 million payroll, still trying to change the culture of losing, you know, still having a hard time drawing fans for the most part. You know, as they try to create identity with that particular team, with that particular baseball team. But some of these other teams, Philadelphia Phillies were on that list with $172 million payroll, which is number two behind the Yankees. The Chicago Cubs were on that list. They sell out every game. They have $126 million payroll. The Detroit Tigers are on the list at $105 million payroll, which is 10th in Major League Baseball. Baltimore, $85 million payroll, 17th on the list. Not surprised by seeing them on the list. But I'm looking at Philly, the Chicago Cubs, Detroit. Those three teams in particular, and saying to myself, how in the world are they on this list? And to me, it doesn't add up because the only thing I've heard for the past, you know, basically since 2003, 2004, is just how great a shape baseball is in economically. You know, all that's Bud Selig's calling card, his rallying cry. We have $7 billion worth of revenue in 2010. The sport is just as popular as it's ever been. And that's all he says. You know, somebody brings up steroids, Selig brings up revenues. $7 billion of revenue. Think about that. The NFL right now is fighting over $9 billion of revenue generated. Baseball generated in 2010, $7 billion of revenue. So how do you have some of these teams in violation of your own debt services rules? Not somebody else's rules, your rules, the rules that you made in terms of debt. It doesn't make much sense to me. Now, it could be two things, or it could be both of these things. One, you're not being truthful about your revenue. So that could be a possibility. Or two, what about the teams? What about the teams? The second thing I'll be concerned about is what about the teams that are not on this list who don't generate the kind of payroll, don't generate the kind of revenue, who are not spending the kind of money that, say, the Yankees, Phillies, Chicago Cubs are. Why are the Marlins not on this list? Why are the Kansas City Royals not on this list? Man, it makes you wonder. Why are the Pittsburgh Pirates not on this list? It's kind of confusing. Why are teams who spend a lot of money and generate revenue on this list versus teams who don't generate a ton of revenue and don't spend a lot of money? Could it be that they're pocketing their money? This is something that, again, you can talk about the Yankees all you want, okay? You can talk about George Steinbrenner, the late George Steinbrenner, all you want about, you know, buying championships and spending this, spending that. Steinbrenner, all those years, was frustrated by the system that he paid money into because of these smaller market teams not spending the money and basically pocketing the money. He had every right to be frustrated by that. Again, I don't understand what I'm missing with this whole situation. Again, baseball wants to brush it off. No, it's not a big deal. Again, is baseball, are the economics of baseball in trouble? I mean, we can't put this in. You cannot put this on the Dodgers and Mets. The Dodgers and Mets are, you know, they don't bring down baseball with what's going on with their revenue. They represent themselves. They're one of the nine teams. They're two of the nine teams that are on this list. You had seven other teams on this list besides the Dodgers and Mets. And again, three of these teams, I'm very much confused by them being on this list. Why are the Indians on this list? The Indians, despite the fact that they're winning, they're not selling out every game. They don't have a big time payroll. Why are they not on this list? Need somebody to explain that to me. Need Buzz Selig to explain that to me. Also, you had the McCourts, Frank McCourt and the LA Dodgers making payroll after borrowing from team sponsors. So you basically, it's going to get to a point where you don't even see, you know, when the Dodgers are at home, you're not going to see, start seeing patches on the Dodger uniforms, you know, Bank of America patches, basically. I don't know if Bank of America represents the Dodgers, you know what I'm saying? It's getting ridiculous with that situation. They're going to have a hard time making payroll in June, considering that they're going to owe Manny Ramirez $6 million from $6 million coming up from off deferred money that they owe to Manny Ramirez. So we'll see if they can make payroll in June, or will Major League Baseball just completely take over take over that team once and for all. 347-215-6180 is your call number. 347-215-6180 is your call number. When we return, we'll talk about the big cactus, Jack Diesel, and why he could have been better. We'll talk about that and much, much more in this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. into this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. So real quick, taking you to the top of the hour as we discuss the world of sports. And Thursday, it was official, made official on Friday, but Thursday, Shaquille O'Neal called it a career after 19 years of play in the NBA. Came in as a 20-year-old, junior from LSU, and six teams later, he calls it a career, 15 All-Star games, four championships, three finals MVPs, as dominant of a player that the game has ever seen, finishes fifth on the all-time scoring list with 28,000 points. And again, in his prime, at his best, outside of Michael Jordan, he was the most dominant player that I ever saw, that I've ever seen. Shaq, I think the three most physically gifted players of all time are Shaquille O'Neal, Will Chamberlain, and LeBron James. In terms of just athletically, physically, just physical specimens, those are the three. Those three stand out. With that being said, as great as he was great. He could have been. He could have been the greatest player of all time if he had that kind of focus, that kind of drive. If he had the drive of Kobe Bryant or Michael Jordan, if he had if he took care of his body like a Kareem Abdul-Jabbar did. He could have been the greatest of all time. Shaq missed over 300 games in his career. Shaq cost the Lakers a championship, a four-peat, or any shot of a four-peat in 2002-2003. Remember, he played the entire playoff season in 2002 with the bad toe. He chooses to wait the entire summer to have before he has surgery. He doesn't do any training camp. And this is the Lakers' first 30 games of that particular season. It may not have been 30 games. I might be exaggerating. Lakers got off to an 11-19 start, so it wasn't their first 30. He missed basically the first, I think, 12 or so games, month of that season. He didn't come back till December. So let me get that corrected. But the Lakers got off to 11-19, and the reason why that was big is they had to fight tooth and nail to just get back into a position where, they were a number five seed. They won 50 games that year. By the time they got to the playoffs, they had nothing left with some of the older players they already had on that team. There was no cruise control that they could play on the regular season. They had to play to the finish. And by the time they got to the second round against San Antonio, they fell hard in that game six. I still believe that, he comes in healthy. They're able to rest players over the course of the season. They're able to kind of go into the playoffs relatively fresh, have a higher seed because they didn't have home court that they, I think, could have won a championship. Now, am I biased? Am I, short-sighted and saying, are you crazy winning a four straight championship? Yeah, you can say that. But we'll never know, of course, because he put them in that position to where they basically almost had no chance. And to me, that's where the Shaq-Kobe relationship really, really unraveled. Kobe Bryant came in that year in as good a shape as he's ever been in his whole career. You remember that year, that's when you say, wow, that's when Kobe Bryant went to another level. He had like eight straight 40-point games. He was doing stuff just putting up ridiculous numbers, carrying the team offensively, as Shaq was still trying to work himself back into shape over the course of that entire season. Never played in 82 games or 50 games. Never played in all the games. Lockout season was only 50. And you look at his career numbers, 23.7, 10.9 rebounds. 10.9 rebounds for a guy, 7'1", 350 pounds, as athletic, as quick as he is a joke. Shaquille O'Neal should have won 6 or 7 rebounding titles. He should have been defensive player of the year three or four times, easily. You know, he was lazy. I mean, there's no Shaq again. When you wanted to play, you saw how dominant he could be. Those three-peat in those NBA Finals games against Dikembe Mutombo. And I forget about who Indiana had, Rick Smithson. Forget about who New Jersey had in terms of the Collins, you know, Jason Collins and you know, those guys. I mean, those guys, forget about those guys. But, you know, the year that they played against the Sixers, 2001, Dikembe Mutombo, Defensive Player of the Year, was one of the great defensive players of all time at the center position. And he abused Mutombo. Jerry West said in a recent interview that he felt sorry for Mutombo. He never seen anybody get dunked on as many times in a series as Mutombo did in that 5-game series. And nobody in the history of the game has ever had that dominant of a stretch in the NBA Finals. Nobody. I mean, not Jordan, not Russell, nobody. When you look at what he did those 3 straight years in the NBA Finals. But he left a lot on the table. And I think he alluded to some of that. Here's what Shaq said at his press conference. Got some audio.
First of all, I'd like to thank everyone for coming out. Appreciate you guys very, very much. Never thought this day would come. And Father Time has finally caught up with Shaquille O'Neal. And I just want to say, was this? Yes. For real? You want me to come up and apply for the New York Knicks general manager job? Okay, sure. I'll be up right after the press conference. Okay, sure. Thank you. That was the president of the Knicks. He wanted me to fly up right after the press conference and try for the general manager job.
Classic Shaq. That's around the press. But he alludes to some of the things that I mentioned about, you know, he even thought he could have been better. In terms of rebounding, you know, could have scored obviously more points, missed over 5,000 free throws. So, you know, he had something trite as far as that came. But regardless of that, you know, again, all time great, one of the top ten players of all time without question, one of the 3 or 4 most dominant players of all time. You certainly make a case that he probably was the third most dominant player behind Michael Jordan and Will Chamberlain. You definitely could make that case. You know, behind the Holy Trinity of centers, of course, with Russell, Chamberlain, Jabbar, he's fourth, and a solid fourth on that list, without question. I mean, he had a career to remember, and again, he was one of the guys who, some guys get it, some guys don't. Shaq absolutely got it as far as being able to market himself. Never got into any trouble off the court, you know, for some of the dumb things that these guys have done in the past 15, 20 years in all sports, DUIs and gun charges, things of that nature. It was flat out funny. I mean, Shaq was he was a stand-up comedian off the court, basically. He was hilarious, and certainly, I know, but the media was on the all-interview team just about every year. And when you were just waiting for a quote out of Shaq over the course of his career. So, again, he will be missing. It's just a sign of the game is changing now. I mean, the game is going into a different mode. So it's going away from that, back to the basket center. And going into, you know, it's a different game. It's more athleticism, more quickness. And so that's kind of like a sign of the times in terms of NBA basketball. Still to come on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, we'll come back, wrap up the program, and look ahead towards some next week's programming. We'll be right back. 57 minutes after the 11 o'clock hour on this last edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. Of course, tomorrow we'll have a post-game edition of the Cyril Quinn Review, the all-critical Game 3 between the Mavericks and Heat in Dallas. 11 times previously in this format, the series has been tied at 1, and all 11 times the winner of Game 3 has won the series. So a big, big Game 3 for both these teams. Bigger for Dallas because, again, if you're Dallas, you can't steal home court advantage and then all of a sudden the next game give it away. So very important for them to win that game. And then really, I mean, they win that game, there's going to be people are going to be talking about the lingering effect from Game 2, and they're also going to be in a position basically to put Miami away in a Game 4 in Dallas. So that, to me, that's a bigger game for Miami. Miami just obviously needs to get one game from here to ensure that they will be going back home for a game six, whether it be up 3-2 or down 3-2. But to me, a bigger game for Dallas. The scary thing for Miami, from a Miami perspective, is Dallas really hasn't even played a complete game yet in the series. You know, they've had spurts. They had moments where they were good in a quarter, good in a half, good in 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there. They had 20 turnovers last game and still won that game. They cut down half on that and took care of basketball. You figure Dallas, you know, role players will play better, be able to shoot the ball better in their home court. I still don't believe that Stojakovic can play in this series. So it'll be very interesting to see how Rick Carlisle navigates his bench and his use of his bench. Also, of course, you have French Open action tomorrow. Nadal and Federer continue their rivalry, their tremendous rivalry that has been one-sided, to say the least. You know, does Federer, how many bullets does Federer have left in the gun? We'll find out to see if he can add to his all-time total of 16 majors. Nadal tries to jump into double digits in terms of majors with his sixth French Open. Stanley Cup playoffs tonight. Boston and Vancouver. Boston lost a heartbreaking game to Vancouver in Game 1. It's going to wrap it up on this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn, this Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. See you tomorrow. So long.